5 minutes on the indemnification issue, but if respondents are going to address the fraud issue first, maybe we should reverse that and have Daniel Schulman go first with the fraud issue.
And I don't have any preference, Your Honor. I would defer to the appellants.
Well, that's maybe okay. We'll start with the indemnification issue with my 5 minutes.
And I think it would be appropriate to have the clock set at 15 minutes, and it'll run continuously for the both of you to use your time as you wish. I think because you have one brief, if not one party, one one client, right?
Two clients, one brief.
Right. Appellant, I see that now. Right. One brief. So we'll give you 15 minutes, and the two of you, co-counsel, can arrange your arguments as you wish.
Great. So I'll go first.
Okay. Please state your name at the beginning.
I'm David Schulman, and I'm representing the appellants Marcos Hernandez and Luisa Violante. The issue I'm addressing is whether the district court properly awarded attorney's fees to respondent Nofray pursuant to a contract term. And I believe this is an issue of first impression in Minnesota, and that issue is whether traditional language in a contract of indemnification gives rise to what's known as first-party indemnification, which means that the other contracting party is liable for the losses incurred by the other party to the contract on its own without involvement of a third party bringing a claim. Very briefly,
I thought it was more of a straightforward contract interpretation question than the broader legal question that you're presenting. Do you see it differently?
Yes. Because it's an issue that has been addressed in other courts, the district court found was that that traditional language of indemnification, which means indemnify, defend, hold harmless, that in effect does not require third party liability or a third party bringing a claim. And that issue has been addressed in the federal courts in particular. We've cited cases, and what those courts have said is that to not require a third party asserting a claim or creating that liability or loss, in effect, reads out of a contract what those terms have always meant, including in Minnesota.
Now the district court in this case, if I understood the thinking correctly as the order was presented, the district court treated the phrase indemnify, defend, and hold harmless as separate potential triggering events and focused on the hold harmless provision. Do you read the district court's order in the same way? And if so, was that a proper approach by the district court?
I don't think the district court parsed it to that extent. I think the three have to be read together. I mean, it is an indemnification paragraph.
I'll just take you to page, looks like your addendum, page 10, which is page 6 of the district court's order, in which the district court, using ellipses, broke out the relevant paragraph this way, or the language in paragraph 9 this way. The relevant language in paragraph 9 provides, and then the quote, defendants shall, ellipsis, hold an offeree harmless from all costs, including reasonable attorney's fees, which an offeree may incur arising from based upon any breach, et cetera. So it seems like that's what the district court was focused on, carving out the indemnification language, and the analysis seems to track that, even though the district court does discuss indemnity as well.
I don't think there's a material difference between holding harmless, defending, and indemnifying. And I think the courts have addressed this issue head on, that's what they find. You have to have that liability created by a third party. And
so the indemnification triggers the hold harmless provision. They're tied together. You don't just have a hold harmless standing alone.
Correct. And it's an that connects them. And I would, boy, time flies up here. And I would also just point to paragraph 8, which is there is a specific provision of the purchase agreement that very specifically says what happens if the buyer does not pay the price for the assets. And what it says is, the seller shall have the right, in addition to all other rights under the law, to re-enter the business, resume ownership, resume operating the business. And
well, there's more. There's other rights under the law. Can you define that term? That's what I'm...
Yes.
Particularly the law. What does the term the law mean in the clause, other rights under the law, in paragraph 8?
The law is the common law of contracts in Minnesota, which does not provide for attorney's fees unless there is a contractual basis for it. And that sounds a little bit circular, but it's not.
So you're not limiting the law to some statute. You're recognizing that a breach of contract claim would be a claim under the law.
Correct. And that's what they prevailed on at trial. That's not on appeal. Right. And that could be specific performance. It could be, there are various remedies, contractual remedies. Right. So here it was limited to re-entry or rights available under the law. If the parties had intended to have attorney's fees available for non-payment of the purchase price, it would have set it there. And what we find, it was actually a respondent.
An argument, I mean, I don't want to suggest that argument doesn't have, I mean, can't really carry the day because it seems circular. If, in fact, there is a right to, the district court was correct in applying paragraph 9, then your argument about paragraph 8 doesn't really apply. I mean, it's if the district court's right under paragraph 9, that in fact it was enforcing the additional rights under the law in paragraph 8. So really your argument hangs on paragraph 9, I think.
That's fair. The last thing that I would say is the cases from this court that have analyzed whether attorney's fees are available under contracts, the language where attorney's fees are awarded by contract, the language is very different from what we have here. You see, typically it says attorney's fees incurred in enforcing the agreement, in protecting rights under the agreement. It's very different from what we have here, which is language of indemnification. And I'd like to stop at this point and have my co-counsel address the fraud issue.
Noted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Dan Shulman for the appellants, and I will address the fraud issue. May it please the court. This is an appeal of a directed verdict on a claim of fraud against the attorney, Mr. Knepp. He was originally Mr. Onofre's attorney. First argument that they raise in their brief is that somehow we've waived the argument, we've waived this appeal because we didn't move for a new trial. There is direct case law that there is no requirement of a motion for a new trial in order to have a directed verdict appealed and reviewed. Now, because it's a directed verdict, all of the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to us. And here, the fraud that is alleged, and it's alleged with particularity at paragraphs 16, 30, 17, and 37 of the amended answer, counterclaim, and third-party claim. It's quite specific that Mr. Knapp submitted false and fraudulent pay records to the Mercado Central in order to obtain their approval of the sale of his of Mr. Onofre's restaurant to Ms. Violante and Mr. Hernandez. And in fact, the jury found that those records were false and fraudulent and that they had been prepared by Mr. Onofre. They found that Mr. Onofre violated the statute against submitting false and fraudulent or creating false and fraudulent records of reimbursement of employees. Now, so what that left was some issues of fact that could and should have been decided by the jury.
But was there ever any evidence presented at that point before the judge made the decision that Mr. Knapp knew the pay stubs were fraudulent or forged when he presented them or sent them?
Yes, there was. The motion for directed verdict was granted at the conclusion of the counterclaim and third-party claim evidence. And there was evidence. For example, 3 years later, that is one of the issues of fact. Did he know? 3 years later, Mr. Knapp, in a trial between the same parties, testified that he had his client testify, and he argued to the court, he represented that Ms. Violante had never been employed by Mr. Onofre.
Now this was, okay, but is there evidence of knowledge at the time? Do you need to have proof that it was at the time that he submitted these fraudulent or forged statements, pay stubs? Did he have to have knowledge at that time? And
yes.
If so, what is the evidence of knowledge at that time as opposed to several years later at a trial?
Well, I would submit that the statement that he made several years later, this is before the pay stubs had ever surfaced, apart from what he sent to the Mercado Central. Number one, the admission 3 years later that she was never an employee, I think, is relevant to determining whether he had that knowledge at the time he submitted the records. Number two, he never provided the records to Ms. Violante and Mr. Hernandez. There's testimony in the record of that. Three, there is evidence of other contemporaneous misrepresentations that he made at the time. Number one, he testified, he said, this was in his interrogatory answers, that he told the Ms. Violante and Mr. Hernandez that they were acquiring only hard assets. The purchase agreement, however, and these are people who did not understand English. The purchase agreement, however, said they were acquiring intangibles, including goodwill. So he misrepresented to them what was in the agreement. In addition, the agreement had two purchase prices in it. One was a purchase price, I think it was $60,000, and then attached to that was a bill of sale, part of the agreement, that said that the purchase price was $75,000. In addition, he submitted financial statements, basically balance sheets for Mr. Hernandez and Mr. Violante that he and Mr. Onofre prepared that Ms. Violante and Mr. Hernandez said that they really were not familiar with. In addition, there is, in this purchase agreement that he drafted, it says that the agreement will become, that they will acquire title, essentially ownership of the property that was being sold at the later of the time they acquire a certificate from the Mercado, or a certificate showing they're capable of operating a restaurant, or the closing date, the later of those two. If you look at the agreement, there's no closing date, which essentially means they could not have acquired. He saved himself basically the position of saying they could never, that they never acquired title.
Well, there's a year, there's a blank, and then a year. So arguably, at some point during that year, there's a requirement that the deal close.
Okay, true.
There's a date, I mean,
yes,
there's a year.
Yes, that's what the agreement says. Finally, there is a question of, and this is an issue of fact too, was he representing them? Were they his clients? His own client, Mr. Onofre, testified that he was representing all three. When he sent the letter to the Mercado, he's not saying that he represented, this was the same date as the agreement. There's no statement in there that he's representing only Mr. Onofre. He says the parties have asked me to do this.
So you're not saying there's any direct evidence of his knowledge that the pay stubs were forged, but that all of this together might leave a jury to do something more than speculate?
Well, yes, circumstantial evidence of a fraudulent intent. Absolutely. And the fact...
But is there circumstantial evidence of his knowledge of the fraud or forgery, I guess, not just of his intent?
Well, yes. I mean, they can infer from that circumstantial evidence that he knew. I mean, that the plaintiffs testified that he never gave, and also he said himself, there's another point, he said himself, well, it's suspicious that these, this is his testimony, it's in the record, in the transcript of his trial testimony, he said it was suspicious that they were never, that there was no signatures on these records he submitted. Well, that would, he said it's suspicious. Of course it's suspicious.
Mr. Shulman, your time has expired.
Thank
but
you.
You and your co-counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents, and I believe first is it Mr. Hackert? Counsel,
yes.
For Mr. Knapp?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yep. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Hackert. I'm appearing on behalf of respondent Douglas E. Knapp. Your Honors, there are essentially two different fraud claims going on in this case. The first fraud claim that was alleged by counsel for appellants was a fraud claim called attorney liability for fraud. And this was based on additional averments of fraud that appeared 2 weeks before trial. This fraud claim sounds in conspiracy or aiding and abetting. And this fraud claim, as this court knows, was not allowed to go forward by the district court judge. The district court judge made findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order for judgment that indicated these particular averments of fraud were not pled properly, were not amended properly, were brought 2 weeks before trial, and Mr. Knapp would be prejudiced by inclusion of this claim. So when we're looking at this attorney liability for fraud claim, Your Honors, I would urge the court to take a look at the Doan case or the Alpha real estate case where the court cites the Souter rule. And the Souter rule indicates that matters of trial procedure, evidentiary rulings, and jury instructions are subject to appellate review only when there's been a motion for new trial. In this case, the appellants did not bring a motion for new trial, assigning the judge's denial of those additional averments as error. And thus, the scope of review by the court should be extremely limited on any of the arguments regarding this attorney liability for fraud case.
Why is there no triable issue as to whether Mr. Knepp became an instrument for the perpetration of the fraud of another?
Well, I think there's an intentional fraud claim, Your Honor, that is a triable issue. And the intentional fraud claim that was pled in the complaint is subject to de novo review by this court. There's a difference between the averments that came out 2 weeks before trial and the original intentional fraud claim that was pled in the complaint and went all the way through trial. So as to the directed verdict that was made on the intentional fraud claim as pled in paragraph 37 of appellant's complaint, that case did go to trial. That was the case that was tried, and the judge did apply the law on that case, and that's the case that the court should be looking at. As this court knows, what happened in this case was the allegations in paragraph 37 of the complaint alleged that Mr. Knepp knowingly included fake paychecks and pay stubs in the documents that he submitted to a third party. When the court looks at the standard for directed verdict, the court not only looks at whether or not appellants have provided a legally sufficient evidentiary basis, but also what is the controlling law on intentional fraud. And I would submit to you the cases cited by appellants in their brief for attorney liability for fraud are not the controlling law. The controlling law we have cited in our brief are the five factors found in Specialized Tours v. Hagen. In Specialized Tours v. Hagen, the court said the required elements of a fraud claim that appellants have to prove are that there was a false misrepresentation of a material fact made with knowledge of the falsity, with the intention to induce another to act in reliance upon, and that they in fact relied upon that. And finally, you have to prove your pecuniary harm. And in this case, when we look at these specialized factors, these have been around in our legal history for a very long time.
Which one of the elements do you think is missed here?
I think all of the elements are missed here, Your Honor. I think that appellants failed to produce any evidence that any of these elements were met because they were busy trying to make a case for this attorney.
As to number one, you don't dispute that the pay stubs were false or fraudulent.
Well, the pay stubs in question, I believe was stipulated at trial that they were not what they appeared to be. They were inaccurate, they weren't real.
So number one is met.
Number one, the false representation would be met. But it also has to be of a material fact.
So going to knowledge, do you dispute that your client, that there was evidence that your client was suspicious about the validity of the pay stubs or the checks?
I do, Your Honor. If you review the transcript of Mr. Knepp's testimony to the court, and I've laid a lot of this testimony out in my brief, Mr. Knepp, at the time these pay stubs were given to him, had no knowledge that they were real or not real. Mr. Knepp testified on...
I understand that, but you're acknowledging that he was suspicious that they may be false.
At that time, Mr. Knepp testified in trial that he didn't know if they were suspicious or weren't suspicious. He came to this realization later,
came
about
to what
3 years later, that these pay stubs were inaccurate.
Right. When did he come to the point of being suspicious?
It was at the time of the first wage trial, about 3 years later.
And the basis for the suspicion was something on the face of the documents,
correct? I believe that Mr. Knepp had a conversation with his client and learned some facts that did not allow him to argue they were accurate information.
To put it a different way, was there information on the face of the documents that would have given Mr. Knepp reason to suspect fraud or forgery?
Mr. Knapp testified that he had no reason to believe they weren't accurate pay stubs. He stated that...
No, that wasn't quite my question. My question was, I'm looking at it from the perspective of a reasonable juror. Was there something on the face of the documents that might give a reasonable person basis to suspect fraud or forgery?
Well, I think that the element of fraud, Your Honor, is... of knowledge is laid out in the Florenzano case.
No, I understand that. But
scienter is an essential element.
But my question is, is there something either omitted or present on the face of any of these documents that would give a reasonable person basis to suspect that they are not valid?
I don't think there was, Your Honor. These types of payroll records can be used for all sorts of different purposes. I don't think that there was anything on those records that would have led Mr. Knapp to believe that they were real or weren't real. At the time...
Were there unsigned checks? I thought I saw something in the record indicating that there were paychecks that were not signed and that formed,
yes, but Mr.
and that formed some basis for suspicion.
The signed checks certainly could have been given out, and these certainly could have been reproductions of payroll records. So when I use QuickBooks, I can certainly print an image of a check that I have given to an employee, but it may not very well be that check for the purposes of proving many things, such as how much the person was paid. I don't believe that...
But he's forwarding these documents for the truth of the circumstance that Ms. Villante was paid.
Well, and I think it comes back to, Your Honor, the fact that Ms. Villante had testified under oath that she was the one that gave Mr. Knapp these documents and represented that these were truthful and accurate representations of what occurred. You have Ms. Villante testifying before Judge Robner saying, yes, I gave these documents to Mr. Knapp. Mr. Knapp represented these parties only for an asset purchase agreement. It was just for the purchase of the business assets. And that isn't just my argument, Your Honor. The document in dispute, the asset purchase agreement, shows it was an asset purchase agreement, not the overall sale of a business. The testimony of Mr. Knapp on cross-examination was that they were only purchasing the assets of the business. And finally, if you look at the cross-examinations of Ms. Villante and the cross-examination of Mr. Hernandez, they both testified when they were asked, what did you think you were buying? The equipment. So it comes back to these pay stubs. Are they material to the transaction that occurred before the pay stubs were even sent to the Mercado Central? They're not even material to the asset purchase agreement, which was just the sale of the assets. These pay stubs came into play after the asset purchase agreement was signed, and they were sent over to this Mercado Central. When the plaintiffs and the defendants all testify it was just a sale of business assets, these pay stubs that we're talking about aren't even material to the underlying transaction. And therefore, the claim fails on materiality. And I don't think the evidence in this case indicated that Mr. Knapp positively knew these pay stubs or these representations weren't genuine.
Do you have to show positive knowledge to get to a jury? Isn't knowledge one of those things that generally is inferred by circumstantial evidence?
Well, the scienter in the Florenzano case and in the Witzman case is an essential element of fraud.
No, I understand it's essential. I'm just... As to the source of proof of, in a criminal context, mens rea, you rarely have evidence that, direct evidence, that an individual has knowledge necessary to prove a claim. Even when you have a case where you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, we're only talking about proof by a preponderance of the evidence here. So why wouldn't circumstantial evidence be a basis to get it in front of a jury as opposed to actual proof of knowledge?
Your Honor, I would love to answer your question, but I see I'm out of time.
Please go ahead and answer the question. Okay.
Circumstantial evidence can be used to show the circumstances surrounding the facts. However, If you're going to make a claim that somebody committed fraud, I believe that you have to prove they knew the representations were false because it is an essential element of the claim. It may show that there may have been a question as to whether they were real or not, but it certainly doesn't meet the scienter requirement.
And you, I just want to be clear, as to your argument, are you conceding or not conceding that circumstantial evidence can be used to prove knowledge?
I would concede that circumstantial evidence could be a factor, but alone by itself cannot prove actual knowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Hackett. Mr. Gavigan, on behalf of the other respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Michael Gavigan of Wilson Law Group on behalf of Respondent Onofre Espinoza. The sole issue, as the court is aware before the court as to Mr. Onofre Espinoza, is the interpretation of language in the agreement as to the scope of indemnification. I won't belabor the point that the court addressed earlier as to paragraph 8, but I would like to say that essentially that cannot be a bar here. There's no reasonable belief that the right of reentry was exclusive, the plain language of the...
Well, I think it's been conceded that if paragraph 8 applies, it's in addition to other rights, is still part of it, and that would only get us to paragraph 9. So if you could, I'm curious about your argument as to paragraph 9 and what indemnification means.
Certainly. Thank you for clarifying, Your Honor. Typically speaking, indemnification has an extraordinarily broad definition and use. Black's Law Dictionary itself defines indemnify or indemnity as a duty to make good any loss, damage, or liability incurred by another. Now, appellants spend a significant amount of time differentiating between first-party and third-party liability. But regardless of which standard we use in this situation, the contract has specific language on point addressing both of those. Probably the most important and essential element of the contract for indemnification here is paragraph 9, subpart A. So subpart A specifies that as to this indemnification, and I'll get to the point about the separate words indemnify, defend, and hold harmless in a moment. The breach of any representation, warranty, covenant, or agreement of buyer contained in this agreement. Appellants are not contesting in this case that there was not a breach on their part. They are not appealing the results of the trial. They're simply saying that this language is essentially not specific enough, not explicit enough to tie the buyer to the responsibility for seller's fees. The main point that I'm trying to make here is, how could paragraph 9A mean anything else? The appellant's argument must fail because they cannot offer a reasonable interpretation of what that language means. Without that, their argument must fail. On its face, it applies to these specific circumstances. The buyer comes in, agrees to the terms, doesn't fulfill the terms it agreed to, and my client incurs costs in the form of attorney's fees as a result of that breach.
Well, it would seem as if that were the purpose, just attorney's fees for breaching the duty to make payment, that a contract would say exactly that in much simpler terms than paragraph 9 and 9A. And these using terms like indemnify and holding harmless. Would you agree that that's usually the language that's used in a contract for attorney's fees for a breach?
I don't think I would agree that there's a best practices manual type language that would specifically define and is found under all circumstances to be adequate.
Best practices would be whatever is most understandable, plain on its face. You would agree this is not... It's at least ambiguous, isn't it?
Oh, no, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I agree it's not phrased in probably the utmost desirable language that we would
look assume
for.
Defend and hold harmless weren't here, and the only term there is indemnify.
Mm-hmm.
Your argument would be the same?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that the...
Have you found a case on that point where indemnify is applied in the way that you are and the district court has applied it here?
Well, again, Your Honor, if we go to the definition of what indemnify typically means, it's extraordinarily broad. And the cases we've cited in our briefing, including the United Prairie Bank Mountain case, dealt with language and indemnification provisions that were at least equally as, I guess, lacking, if you want to address it that way. But what they say is essentially the same language. That bundle of terms, the indemnify, defend, and hold seller harmless, that's generally descriptive language for the concept of indemnity as a whole. And the concept of indemnity as a whole, as Black's Law Dictionary and the other cases cited in the materials show, is very broad. The reason that there's a lack of Minnesota authority for the appellants to rely on is because Minnesota courts do not interpret indemnity the same way as the courts in Iowa and New York did in trying to specifically parse out this first and third party. The Minnesota authority says, is the language clear enough so that we know what the intent was? And it doesn't have to be unequivocal, but I would again point to the language in 9A versus 9B and C. 9B and C clearly apply to third parties. It goes to things like vendor's rights, damage as the result of the using the equipment that was transferred. 9A has no arguable basis for applying that same way.
Given the presumption in Minnesota against awarding attorney's fees and the requirement that there be some statute or contract language providing for it, if this is a toss-up, don't we rule against your client?
No, I see that my time is out. May I respond
yes,
to the court's inquiry?
Yes,
thank you. I don't believe so.
You don't believe it's a toss-up, or you don't believe if it's a toss-up, you lose?
Either, Your Honor. So in the event that it's a toss-up, I guess that would say, what is this a toss-up between? Is it a toss-up between whether it's ambiguous or not? Or is it a toss-up between whether one of these provisions applies specifically to these circumstances?
A toss-up between
not?
the meaning that... indemnify means the payment by the buyer of attorney's fees for a breach of contract as opposed to paying for some third-party liability.
And I would say that the contract is unequivocal and unambiguous as to that point. That is specifically why
they're... You're saying it's not a toss-up.
It's not a toss-up.
But if it were?
If it were a toss-up between how this applies... Then the court is entitled to engage in the de novo review and come up with its own conclusions as to how this language should be interpreted and what is reasonable. But my argument is, there's no reasonable way to interpret this as accepting the attorney's fee award that was made in this case. And the court is specifically obligated to make findings and determinations consistent with what the jury's verdict was. And the court's argument and analysis at the trial level was persuasive and reasonable.
Paragraph 4 is captioned assumption of liabilities. And it says, buyer shall assume the following liabilities and obligations related to the premises, leases of personal property, and so on. I mean, doesn't that create a possibility that the buyer could breach one of those obligations, therefore causing seller to incur liability to a third party?
Yes. I'm not here making an argument that there were not aspects of the agreement that could have been breached and result in direct third-party liability as we typically think of it.
But doesn't that then inform our understanding of Clause 9A?
Certainly. I'm not arguing that 9A could not be interpreted in such a way that there would be other breaches that could affect third-party liability. What I'm saying is it plainly encompasses the non-payment by the buyer, which is probably the most single important representation and promise they are making. And this language in 9A cannot be interpreted so as to exclude that breach.
Is your interpretation of indemnify here rely upon a rule of first impression? That there's no case you have found, I'm sure you would have cited for us, had you found a case in Minnesota that that applies the term indemnity in the way that you are construing it?
Again, Your Honor, I would say that I'm not aware of a case that interprets this particular contractual language as it's stated, but we tried to cite language that we believe is the substantial equivalent or even less clear than what is cited here, and that includes the United Prairie decision I already mentioned and the Bollinger and Brown decisions that are cited in the materials.
Time's expired, but may I ask one more?
Of course.
The conjunction here is, it's not disjunctive, it's conjunctive, and. Indemnify, defend, and hold harmless. All three of those would have to apply for this clause to apply, wouldn't it? I mean, it have to be the contract contemplates a situation where there is some liability that involves indemnification, defense, and holding harmless.
If I'm understanding the court's question correctly, I don't think that's accurate. The reason it's conjunctive that way is they have each of these obligations. Each of those separate phrases is arguably a distinct portion of indemnity. That's why it's conjunctive, because all of those aspects of indemnification apply in the contract. It's not a requirement that they have to have a legal action against them in which they have to defend, and that there be third-party losses or liabilities incurred. It's that if any of those does occur, they have each of those three obligations as part of indemnification. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gavigan. Appellant's counsel have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel said that Minnesota decisions define indemnity or indemnify broadly. I don't think that's true, Your Honor. The case of Guess v. Priore, it's a Westlaw case, 2006 Westlaw, 247-4095, quote, this court, quote, indemnify is defined as to reimburse another for loss suffered because of a third party's act or default. That quotes, and that is quoting Black's Law Dictionary. So we're not aware of any authority that supports their position that indemnify means paying the other party for a contract for losses caused by the first party. And in fact, all the decisions we found, which we've cited, including the Third Circuit's decision in the Damman case, D-A-M-M-A-N-N, says that it must interpret the word indemnify in relation to the words defend and hold harmless. So it's all part of the same ball of wax. It means that if the other party to a contract has to incur some liability, as Justice Johnson suggested, for example, Violante and Hernandez don't pay the rent and Onofre gets sued by the Mercado, then that would create an indemnity situation, but not their failure to pay the purchase price. Now, let me address the issue of knowledge. First of all, another item of circumstantial evidence here is that the pay stubs that were submitted were not requested by the Mercado. This was something that Mr. Knepp volunteered, that he submitted voluntarily. He had a list of items. He had a letter from the Mercado. They said, we need this information. He provided that information.
How is that circumstantial evidence of his knowledge of the falsity of the documents?
Because it's just one piece. It's a mosaic.
Right, but how does that mosaic add any weight, any probative weight, to the allegation that he had knowledge of the falsity of the documents?
combine it with the fact that he knew that the Mercado was about to evict Onofre and eliminate his membership, kick him out, basically kick him out of the membership in the Mercado.
Okay, if you put those two facts together, why is that probative of his knowledge of the falsity? I mean, certainly probative of his motive in providing the documents, right, which is to encourage the agreement. But how is it probative of the relevant issue, which is his knowledge of the falsity?
Okay. Add that the suspicious nature of the documents that were submitted. Also add the other misrepresentations that he made to Hernandez and Violante in the course of the, you know, claiming to explain the contract. There's another factor, which is that we're dealing with credibility here. And the jury had an opportunity to observe this man's credibility. He was impeached with his interrogatory answers. He was impeached with the contents of the agreement that he drafted. He was impeached on other factors. You have my cross-examination. That is in the record.
Now, a jury might believe that that he wasn't making false statements about the nature of the deal, but the jury might have believed he was mistaken, as he claimed.
And the jury could also believe that he knew that it was false. He claims to have got these. His defense was, his explanation was, I got these documents from Ms. Violante. She denied that. She said, and there's evidence, I mean, that they came from, they were created. First of all, they were created by his own client who knew they were false. By saying that he got them from Ms. Violante, that created an issue of fact. The jury was entitled to resolve that issue of fact. I mean, you know, as you pointed out, I mean, I'm an antitrust lawyer. I've been trying conspiracy cases for 49 years. And intent, knowledge, are almost never proved by direct evidence. These are things that have to be proved by circumstantial evidence. Here is a witness who was shown to have testified falsely about a number of things. The jury was falsus in uno, falsus in omnis. The jury could have concluded that his denial was false about his knowledge of the falsity of the agreement. I see my time is up. If the court has no questions, I'm done. Thank you.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Shulman. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.